projects we're seeing unfolding here. Because I think, and what I wrote about in the piece is, I think there's basically three somewhat distinct political projects underway here that haven't really had the chance to weave together and have the space close to power the way that they have now in the past. The first one is the idea that the government should be run like a corporation, right? There's a kind of a core Clintonite notion here that we should treat citizens like consumers. We should, you know, expose bureaucracy to the same kind of competitive pressures and kind of hallmarking and benchmarking that private companies are. And then you have to go in and sort of act like an asset stripping private equity firm and peel out all the waste and abuse and put back in sort of more efficient processes. That's how Musk sold Doge to the American people in late 2024. And that's actually why even some Democrats were on board with a Doge caucus already in December still. So there's something kind of normal about that. And there's a reason why Musk has been posting pictures of Clinton and Gore saying, hey, I'm just doing that sort of business here. But obviously, things have gone to another level. And the second, I think, strain of politics that's plugged in here is closer to that of Russell Vogt at the Office of the Management of Budget, one of the people who was critical to the Project 2025 document. And that is a more often Christian conservative sort of think tank vision of deconstructing the administrative state, not to make it more efficient and to cost cut to get to more efficiency and sort of productivity, but because you think certain things that the government has been doing are fundamentally illegitimate. So there should be no kind of redistributive role for the government. There should be no role covering things like the protection of the environment or the provision of special education or the provision of sort of projects towards gender equity, anti-racism, and things of that nature. So the idea there is you permanently sort of hobble the Leviathan of the state and, you know, hack back some of its capacity, send that back to the states, and produce a government that governs intensively but not extensively. So, you know, border, military budget, maybe federal abortion bans, but all the other sort of post-civil rights, great society programs get sort of permanently euthanized. The third strain, though, that sort of gets to some of the more extreme dynamics that people have been picking up on is what I think you can call right-wing accelerationism. So this is a kind of very online ideology often associated with people like Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land. And there the idea is that you don't just sort of trim the state or kind of streamline it, but you shatter it all together. And so there's a vision of total decentralization of sovereignty back to smaller kind of fortified private enclaves, turning the United States into a kind of a patchwork of fiefdoms or sovcorps, as Yarvin calls them, where people are sort of, you know, opting in, paying to get into gated communities, and then sort of in zero-sum social Darwinist competition with the world beyond them. And that's quite sci-fi and kind of speculative. But at times, I think that the sort of sense of panic that we feel is people wondering whether you can just delete all of the kind of capacities of the state and expect to be able to plug them back in at any level afterwards, or if there is a kind of irreversible process of dismantlement happening here.
And so, Professor Slobodian, we'll get to Curtis Yarvin in a minute, whom you mentioned. But if you could elaborate on some of the ideological precursors to these three strains you identify. I mean, you mentioned in the second, for example, deconstructing the administrative state. We heard that first from Steve Bannon. So if you could, you know, elaborate on where these strains are coming from within the American political tradition, most recently, the last Trump administration, but also prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, many of these things that we think of as kind of natural parts of the way the U.S. government operates, for example, something like income tax, are actually just over 100 years old. So the idea of having a federal government that oversees many parts of social life is actually, you know, it's only a few generations in the past. And there are conservatives who see that as a kind of a project of decline. So famous examples would be someone like James Burnham, who wrote about what he called a managerial revolution. So there was this fear that, you know, that the kind of the essence of American enterprise was being strangled because there were just all of these civil servants producing a kind of a sclerotic layer over the economy and just pursuing their own kind of ideological project. So Russell Vought at OMB talks about what he calls the woke and weaponized bureaucracy. He talks about almost complete Marxist takeover of the government. So this isn't really that much of a sort of neoliberal economic way of thinking. It's this belief that the state is a kind of a battlefield for opposing ideologies. And that's been, you know, pretty consistent on the American right and is now, and certainly was informing Steve Bannon's more cultural and political idea of the kind of wars that need to be fought inside of bureaucracy and indeed outside of it.
And can you talk about that battle right now between Bannon and Elon Musk and who, in fact, is winning? He's been talking about vowing to get Elon Musk kicked out, just said he's a truly evil guy, a very bad guy, and most recently referred to him as a parasitic illegal immigrant. Talk more about these two strains.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this really flared up, obviously, at the end of last year with the debate about immigration, with the sort of Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, Silicon Valley wing defending temporary visas, so-called H-1B visas, for their sector because they need a lot of skilled workers kind of in the back office. And then Bannon saying that that was itself unpatriotic and there needed to be American jobs for American native workers policy and a much more complete kind of exclusion of you know, new incoming workers. What was interesting is that got extremely heated. I mean, as you say, Bannon has been not holding back at all in the way he's been describing Silicon Valley as an apartheid state. He's even using categories that are more common on the left, like calling it techno-feudalism, and claiming that like the bayonets are out and he's advancing and he's coming for Musk. But what's symptomatic and interesting there is the way that Trump has sort of kept aloof from the whole conflict, right? I think that he is probably instinctively seeing that you don't actually need to choose a side. Actually, you can accommodate, and you will, I think, and are accommodating both sides of this apparent schism inside of the big MAGA coalition. So there's no reason why the kind of hard border nativists can't get the kind of sadistic roundups that, you know, we're talking about at the top of the program, can't produce terror in the lives of young people in the way that they are doing so effectively, that will fulfill the kind of libidinal sadistic desires of a certain sector of the MAGA coalition, even as, you know, more quietly you keep doing more pragmatic immigration policy to, you know, fill out the programmers in the back offices of Silicon Valley. I think that more likely than not, we're going to get a mixture of both. And as to who gets closest to Trump's ear, I mean, the answer, I think, is in the bank accounts. There are 500 billion reasons why Trump is going to listen to Musk more than he's going to listen to Bannon. And Trump is a person who doesn't believe in much, but he believes in money. And he doesn't trust many people, but he trusts people who are richer than him. And Musk's ability to kind of, you know, stroll through the White House as if he has been elected himself, have his three-year-old sort of like muttering to Trump in the middle of a press conference, I think it gives us as much evidence as we need of the fact that he is being given kind of carte blanche here to act as effectively unelected co-president.
Well, let's go back to Curtis Yarvin, who you mentioned earlier. This is Yarvin speaking on the New York Times podcast, The Interview, last month. In this clip, he's asked about his belief that the Civil War and the end of chattel slavery were bad for the formerly enslaved.
But are you seriously arguing that that the era of slavery was somehow better than the era?
The era of 1865 to 1875 was absolutely, and the war itself wasn't good either. But if you look at the living conditions for an African American in the South, they are absolutely at their nadir between 1865 and 1875. They are very, very bad because basically this economic system has been disrupted.
But abolition was a necessary step to get through that period towards to make people free.
Sure.
Like, I can't believe I'm arguing
Brazil abolished slavery in the 1880s without a civil war.
So that was Curtis Yarvin, someone who Vice President J.D. Vance frequently invokes. And back in 2021, Vance, then an Ohio candidate for U.S. Senate, he was interviewed by the conservative Jack Murphy Live podcast. Murphy just asked Vance how to root out wokeism from American institutions.
There's this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who's written about some of these things. And so one is to basically accept that this entire thing is going to fall in on itself, right? I tend to think that we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left, right? We need like a de-bathification program, but like a de-wokeification program in the United States, right?
So if you could tell us, Professor Slobodian, who is Curtis Yarvin? You note in your recent New York Review of Books piece, his idea, this is quote, his idea of rage, retire all government employees, looks a lot like that of Doge. So who is this guy? Where did he emerge from? And how did he become so influential?
Yeah, I mean, he was someone who moved to the Bay Area and became a computer programmer, also kind of an amateur poet, and I guess most importantly, a pretty widely read blogger in the 2000s, especially the late 2000s, under the name Mencius Moldbug. And he became someone who was kind of giving voice to a nascent kind of what was called neo-reactionary or dark enlightenment sentiment in Silicon Valley, which I think combines, as the way I've been describing it, a kind of belief in economistic bottom line thinking and productivity, but then also an idea that what we need to get back to is a proper sense of hierarchy in this country and in the world. So one of the problems of the administrative state is that it has been pursuing equality, and it's been working under the false assumption that all humans are somehow equal. That in fact, there are kind of hierarchies of intelligence best measured in IQ, which people like Yarvin and increasingly Vance and Trump are seemingly quite obsessed with. It can be measured in things like race. Group differences in IQ are, you know, commonly assumed to be real empirical facts in the world of the sort of Silicon Valley right. And perhaps most importantly, into hierarchies of gender. So the masculinity component in all of this is kind of impossible to overstate. There is a reason why this sort of apparent scrambling of gender in gender queer and trans movements is so triggering and so terrifying to people in this world. Elon Musk has described the woke mind virus as having killed his child, even though his child is very much alive. So the project, I think, is really about how through the mechanisms of the market and the dismantlement of the sort of post-New Deal state, the post-Great Society and civil rights state, we can get back to what they see as a more natural world where men are in charge, white people are in charge, and there is a kind of restoration of the natural order of things. And that sort of wishy-washy treatment of things like slavery is a sort of a provocative way of reopening those questions.
And Professor Slobodian, this is about both J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, the question of their stance on the far-right German party AfD. On Friday, Vice President J.D. Vance gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference where he repeatedly attacked Europe on a number of issues. And he, while in Germany, held a 30-minute meeting Friday with the head of Germany's far-right AfD party, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, rebuking Vance for meeting with the AfD ahead of Germany's election. And of course, you have Elon Musk repeatedly using his social media platform X to support what many call the neo-Nazi party or the Nazi curious party, for those who are more generous.
Yeah, I mean, the AfD in Germany is actually a really good example of one of these sort of strange bedfellow type parties that I actually think is sort of unhelpfully described as either neo-Nazi or Nazi curious. What it actually is it was founded by ordo-liberal economics professors who disliked the way Merkel was handling the Eurozone crisis and thought you needed more monetary discipline and more fiscal discipline. They then created an alliance with basically ethno-nationalists, traditionalist members of the so-called New Right, who felt that modernity had produced a fallen world and we needed to get back to more rooted links to the land and that certain populations belonged in some spaces and not others. And then now they have created this kind of this far right neoliberal party that Alice Weidel sort of gives voice to when she says that, you know, we're actually a libertarian conservative party, as she said in her Spaces chat with Musk. The AFD is one of only many far right parties that now Musk is aggressively platforming. In the last few days, he's promoted Viktor Orban, Giorgio Meloni, the AFD, and in the past has gone as far as promoting Tommy Robinson, the sort of far-right figure from the UK. He has adopted not just sort of a tame language of democracy, as Vance tends to be using, but a language, as he used in the rally that he zoomed into, of Germany for the Germans, and saying that multiculturalism must not be allowed to dilute the German people. So these are now proper tropes of the far right as such, and indeed tropes of the great replacement theory, which suggests that liberals have used welfare policy and refugee policy to buy voters, which can then swamp and dilute the native population. This has now become a common talking point. The thing that I think is interesting and important, and perhaps a sign of rare optimism these days, is that Germans actually don't like Elon Musk interfering in their politics. Polls have showed that of non-AFD voters, you know, well over three quarters thinks he has no right to butt in. And even among AFD voters, only about half actually wants him to be involved. So I think what we're seeing already is a bit of a backlash against his attempt to kind of, you know, play kingmaker in countries, another country that is not his own. The left party in Germany has had a surge in recent weeks. They have more people entering the party now than they have since 2009. That's partially on the back of like a really full-throated anti-fascist call for the defense of democratic principles by the young leaders, the young female leaders of that party. So I think there is a chance here of his belief that he can just, you know, play puppet master globally, actually having a boomerang effect and backlashing on his own attempts at manipulation.
Quinn Slobodian, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of international history at Boston University, author of Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. We'll also link to your New York Review of Books headlined Speed Up the Breakdown. When we come back, an update on the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
Tout ce sang des crises et des pleurs. Y en a marre de toutes ces guerres. Que faisons-nous de toutes ces terres? Un champ de bataille propice pour des meurtres. Au nom de quoi on doit subir tout ça? Il est temps de mettre fin à ce carnage. Tout ce en quoi je crois se résume pas à ça. Tous les jours des familles plient bagages. Tole limingio, pardon et coquille.
Amani, which means peace, by the Congolese singer Oliver Mann. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
We turn now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the Rwanda-backed M23 armed group has taken vast areas of the eastern DRC and is marching on the strategic city of Uvira near the border with Burundi, triggering panic, with residents reporting widespread looting, bodies lying in the streets, and government forces commandeering boats to escape the insurgents' advance. M23 is also advancing on the city of Butembo, north of Goma, which the armed group seized in January in an offensive that killed some 3,000 people. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has accused M23 of killing children and attacking hospitals and warehouses storing humanitarian aid, and says as many as 15,000 people have fled into Burundi in recent days. On Wednesday, the Congolese foreign minister addressed the UN Security Council.
We are looking for a political solution and we're committed to it. The problem that we have is that despite the commitments that Rwanda or the lip service that Rwanda serves to the cause of a political solution, when we look on the ground, we see desolation. We see the constant advance of the M23. We see executions of children, as reported by the OHCHR yesterday. And we see that Rwanda is not being faithful or keeping their words and not being sincere in engaging in a political solution.
In an interview with CNN earlier this month, Rwandan President Paul Kagame claimed he was unaware of any Rwandan military troops fighting in the eastern DRC.
Today, on the 3rd of February, does Rwanda currently have any troops at all in eastern DRC?
I don't know.
You're the commander-in-chief.
Yeah. There are many things I don't know.
That was Kagame, the president of Rwanda, being interviewed by CNN's Larry Madowo. For more, we're joined by the Congolese analyst and activist Kambale Musavuli, who's now based in Accra, Ghana, policy analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo-Kinshasa. And his latest piece for People's Dispatch headlined, "The Battle for Control of Goma Continues." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Kambale. It's great to have you with us again this week, but under horrible circumstances. Explain the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo for people who are not aware of what is happening, how dire it is, and what you think needs to happen.
Since the beginning of the year, we've had over 500,000 people who have been displaced in the east, added to the 6 million already displaced in the country. And this is caused by the uprising of the M23. It's a militia group that has existed in the Congo under different names. And this is their latest uprising, as they're taking over town after town. Killings are taking place. For example, for the city of Goma, at least 3,000 people have been killed in the city during the battle of taking over Goma. And just yesterday, we're finding out more information about the taking over of the city of Bukavu. But this battle, which has been raging for close to 30 years, is always about the control of Congo's mineral wealth. Congolese are paying the price as the world needs Congo's resources. Unfortunately, strong actions are not being taken to bring about peace and stability in the Congo. And we know what needs to happen. You know, international pressure on Rwanda and Uganda, to some extent, will bring about peace and stability. It was done in 2012. It's not being done now.
So, Kambale, can you explain why you think that's the case? The last time you were on the show, you said the same thing, as indeed in an opinion piece in the New York Times that appeared yesterday. Nobel laureate Denis Mukwege, a Congolese Nobel laureate, peace laureate, made exactly the same argument. So what is the difference between 2012 and now?
There seems to be, in my view, a geopolitical consideration from Western countries who benefit from Congo's resources. If you look at an article that came out just last month from Sky News, the reporter was analyzing the European Union. The European Union has an agreement with Rwanda on getting access to critical minerals, and they are refusing to cancel that agreement when we all know that minerals being sold by Rwanda in the quantity that it's doing is actually coming from the DRC. The consideration for the European Union is that by canceling this contract, it will give ways to Russia and China getting access to mineral resources, clearly telling us that the lives of the millions of Congolese do not matter. That's on one level the reason why there is no action. The other one is the world apathy. The information being accessible or available on the DRC is there. Even African nations are not taking the necessary actions for that. So this is an appeal for ordinary citizens, that we are saying that we can talk about the fourth industrial revolution with Congo's resources, but we should not have blood in the technology devices that we are using. So it's up to the citizens in the biggest metropolitan, the United States, that's benefiting from the pilfering of Congo's resources, European nations, and including the UK. World pressure of ordinary citizens is going to support the Congolese in the struggle to bring about peace and stability.
I wanted to ask you about the West's support for Rwanda. This goes to a number of issues. We just spoke to you a few days ago about the Oscar-nominated documentary soundtrack to a coup d'etat, about what the U.S. did with its involvement in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first independence leader of modern-day Congo, and using black jazz musicians in the United States in cementing the U.S. relationship and trying to get access to all the rare metals. Now I wanted to come here to 2025. Earlier this month, DRC's foreign minister urged three football clubs, Arsenal, Bayern Munich, and Paris Saint-Germain, to end their, quote, bloodstained sponsorship agreements with Visit Rwanda, questioning the morality of such partnerships. Just today, Reuters reports Rwanda has described this criticism as a threat to regional peace and security. Meanwhile, the musician John Legend is scheduled to headline Global Citizens Move Africa Tour and play in Kigali, the Rwandan capital, on Friday. The Nigerian Grammy-winning singer Tems recently canceled her appearance, saying, quote, "So I recently promoted my show in Rwanda without realizing that there's ongoing conflict between Rwanda and Congo. I never, ever intend to be insensitive to real-world issues, and I sincerely apologize if this came across that way. I simply had no idea this was going on. My heart goes out to those affected. Conflict is no joke, and I truly hope and pray for peace in this time." If you can talk about both the concert, John Legend participating, but of course the bigger issue, also the sports teams, all this Western support for Rwanda and how it's furthered the conflict in Congo.
This is a form of soft power that these institutions and individuals are doing. I mean, John Legend going to Rwanda in the midst of 3,000 people being killed, children being recruited by militia groups. And it's not that he's not aware. There have been a campaign for close to 2 months now, letting him know that he should not attend. No, Tems took action. So all the people who support him, he's not the only one. Dave Chappelle traveled to Kigali and took a picture with Paul Kagame. You have even Kendrick Lamar, who was just headlining at the NFL, had a concert in Kigali, and at the end of the concert, he was on stage with Paul Kagame. So when people in the United States watch the news and see Kendrick Lamar, see John Legend, see Dave Chappelle with Paul Kagame, and the usual people, you know, you had Tim Cook for Apple also with him, it creates an image that this is a great leader, a non-criminal leader, who's helping his country. So it's a form of soft power to actually cover that. And we have to expose it. Now, this, as you pointed out in the film, Central to a Coup d'Etat, showed that in the past, the State Department and CIA used artists as a ploy for soft power. Right now, the same thing is happening. I think that should be exposed. It's critical for ordinary people to challenge them. Even to go to the NBA. I mean, the NBA Africa, they are lobbying to engage on the African continent. On the day of the All-Stars, there was a protest outside of the All-Stars game where ordinary Americans were saying the NBA has blood in its hands for collaborating with Rwanda. So we have to expose all these contradictions. But we must not forget that this battle is very dire. You know, people are being killed on a daily basis. Congo's territorial integrity is affected. The Congolese have called for Rwandan troops to leave. And all of us around the world, we have to do everything in our power to join the Free Congo campaign, to put pressure on Rwanda and any negative forces so that Congolese can have a chance to change the country.
Kambale Musavuli, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Congolese analyst and activist now based in Accra, Ghana. Policy analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa. We'll link to your piece in People's Dispatch. It's headlined, "The Battle for Control of Goma Continues." To see our extended interview with Kambale from a few days ago, you can go to democracynow.org, as well as a full interview with the director of the Oscar-nominated film Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat that includes a number of clips of this documentary about U.S. involvement, Belgian involvement with the assassination of the Congolese independence leader Patrice Lumumba, and how the U.S. State Department deployed black jazz musicians who would later revolt against what they had done in Congo by protesting at the U.N. General Assembly after Lumumba was killed, shouting assassin and murderer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.